From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. As she grew up, Petula Caesar's African-American father praised her good grades and her light skin. He raised her to be deferential to white people and to see blacks as dangerous.
So he knew that life might not treat me kindly, and no parent wants that for their child. And he figured this was the best way to send me out there, and it wasn't.
Then Sujata Massey's newest novel is The Widows of Malabar Hill, set almost a century ago in what's now Mumbai, India. Her heroine, whose traditional ethnic last name is just one syllable shy of mystery, is a pioneering lawyer who comes upon murder, kidnapping, and a secret passageway as she investigates a suspicious will. A memoir and a mystery on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Growing up in New Jersey and later in Baltimore, Petula Caesar had her parents' undivided attention. They bought her every toy she could wish for, stocked their home with books for her to read, and lavished praise on her for her good grades and her pale complexion. That was the rub. Petula's light-skinned, straight-haired African-American father had no use for black culture and a horror of dark complexions. As Caesar tells it in her new memoir titled, She's Such a Bright Girl, An American Story, her parents imparted countless messages that white people were to be emulated and black people, for the most part, could not be trusted. How she came to grips with those messages is the point of the book. And Petula Caesar is here to share the story. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much for having me, Sheila. I appreciate it.
Before you told us anything about your own growing up, you start your book with some scenes of various family members relating to your young daughter, Jasmine, who looked a lot like you, including a Sunday morning when she was about 4 years old visiting your parents.
Yes.
What happened?
The Sunday morning breakfast was kind of a tradition in my family. So I would bring my daughter to my parents' house in East Baltimore to have breakfast on Sundays with them. Very typical Sunday morning. My parents are in the basement where the kitchen is. My daughter runs over to my dad. She was very, very close to him. And they're having a very lovely grandfather-granddaughter moment. And he looks at his granddaughter, then looks at me and says, Jasmine's lovely, other complimentary things, but it's such a shame about her hair. And she's literally sitting on his lap just inches away. And of course, she's horrified. She grabs her hair and she says, Mom, Grandpa, what's wrong with my hair? And she's just totally devastated and freaked out. And then I am charged with the task of keeping my daughter calm and not being as angry as I would have liked to have been in that moment. So there was a lot of juggling and balancing for me.
And why was that where you wanted to start your story?
Well, for a few reasons. Because my daughter is relatively young, she's in her 20s now, I wanted to make the point that this is not something that happened a long time ago, or that this is not something that we've gotten past or gotten over. It's still very prevalent in the black community. The second point I wanted to make was that I wanted it not to just be about me and my struggle in particular, because when these types of things happen in families, they don't just happen to the immediate participants. They make their way forward into the next generations and so on and so on and so forth. And in that moment, I really, really wanted my mom in particular to kind of come and rescue my daughter from what was happening, and to kind of indirectly rescue me, because I'd had similar things happen to me as a child. So I wanted to really drive home that point of these things really are generational. They happen to you and they're perpetuated and they move forward unless you really make a point to try to put a stop to it.
Your parents never spanked you?
No, they did not.
And they spread the rule among the extended family, like when you were visiting cousins in Jenkin Jones, West Virginia, where your
yes.
parents grew up.
Yes.
They were not to use corporal punishment.
No, no one was to lay a finger on me for any infraction under any circumstances. It just was not done. It was made extremely clear, almost on the pain of death, that you just didn't do that to Petula.
And you asked your dad why?
Yes, I did once I figured it out. Initially, it just seemed very normal to me. Typically, as a child, what happens in your home, you kind of figure that's what happens everywhere. As I got a little older, I realized a lot of my peers did get spankings and things like that. So I did ask my dad eventually if it were true that he had made that comment, that order. He'd sent that order sort of down to the family. By this time, I kind of heard from my mom that he'd given those instructions. So I asked him if it were true. He said yes. And he explained that he did not want me to think that violence was normal. He went on further to make the point that it was very unfortunate that Black people were so naturally violent and that they just did not know how to conduct themselves in any other way. They were just naturally hot-headed and had bad tempers and just inflicted all this pain and violence on each other. And because of this, white people did not want to be around them. And he did not want to set those kind of examples for me. So he had ordered all the people in the family, all the Black people, not to inflict physical violence on me so I would not think it was normal. And that would cause me to go out into the world and not perpetuate violence to others, and that would make me more acceptable to white people.
That's writer and performance poet Petula Caesar here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her new memoir, She's Such a Bright Girl, An American Story. On Saturday, she'll host a luncheon and panel discussion about it near Mondawmin Mall. You were 12, about to start junior high, when your family moved to Baltimore. How did that change things?
So I came to Baltimore and I found I wasn't teased as much about my complexion. I found it a little bit easier to kind of navigate my social circle as a preteen and as a teenager when I came here. In New Jersey, it was much, much more challenging. I was literally chased home from school, beat up, all kinds of things. That didn't happen as much in Baltimore until I got a little bit closer to adulthood. So Baltimore, in a lot of respects, treated me very well when I got here initially, and I really was very, very glad to be here.
You were always a good student.
You
yes. wrote great essays, got accepted at all five colleges you applied to, including your first choice, Howard University in Washington, but you didn't end up going there.
No, I did not, much to my chagrin to this day. Initially, my dad was supportive of my decision to go to Howard because that's what you do when your child gets into college. You say good job and congratulations and all those things. But as it got closer to the time for me to actually go to Washington, he changed his tune. He started saying things to discourage me. He sabotaged my self-confidence, to be honest with you. He would say things like, you'll be there all alone and we won't be here to help you, as if Howard was just so far away. And you know, will you be all right around all those Black people? And will you really be challenged academically at a Black school? Because that's not really what the world is. And my mother just kind of deferred to him. She just kind of said, well, I just think your dad knows what would be best for you. So from the time that I actually got my acceptance, which was like in April, he started the campaign. And by the time July rolled around, I just didn't feel like I could do it. So I ended up not going to Howard, and I went to my fifth choice school, which was Towson. That was not a fun time.
And you only stayed about half a semester.
I stayed from August when I moved into the dorms, went home early for Thanksgiving break, and did not go back.
Early in your book, you write, quote, even now, I know Dad did it all for me. It was done to make me the best version of me possible, close quote. What should we understand about that?
When I initially started writing this book, it even had a different title and just a different perspective. As I started writing it, I came to realize I was still dealing with how I felt about all of this. But I really, really had to think about where my father came from and the experiences he had that I know nothing about. I can't possibly imagine all that he had to quell within himself just to survive. So I know that he really meant well. He really thought that the things that he did were the best way to send me off into the world successfully. He didn't want me to experience the trauma that he experienced himself and that had witnessed. So he knew that life might not treat me kindly. And no parent wants that for their child. And he figured this was the best way to send me out there. And it wasn't.
So what do you hope this book accomplishes?
Like most writers, telling my story is just important to me. Beyond that, oftentimes we do not take the time to really think about why we are the way we are. Sometimes life gets very, very challenging and difficult, and a lot of our energy and efforts really get focused into day-to-day survival. And you don't always take the time you'd like to really reflect on, why do I feel the way I do? And why do I respond to certain things and situations the way I do? And it just seems like a luxury that we can't afford for some reason. But it is so vitally important, because everything we are starts with what we think about ourselves and our circumstances. So I'm trying to encourage us to find a space to think about how we got to be the way we are, particularly as it relates to colorism in the African-American community. It is definitely still a thing. It is still something that we struggle with and that we need to discuss from all kinds of angles. So I also really want to introduce that conversation into the forefront of the conversations that we have about race, because how we identify racially does affect a lot of the ways that we think. And I realize how important that is, especially after writing this book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Petula Caesar is a writer, artist, and performance poet. Her new memoir is She's Such a Bright Girl, An American Story. A book release luncheon and panel discussion about a book's themes will take place Saturday, starting at 12:30, at Touchpoint Baltimore, near Mondawmin Mall. The address is 2401 Liberty Heights Avenue. We have a link to information and registration at the On the Record page, WYPR.org. Quick break now, On the Record, and then another Baltimore author whose book takes a new look at identity. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Now we turn to a mystery set in India that weaves together the life of Bombay's first female lawyer, named Purving Mistry, with the death of a wealthy Muslim businessman. The Widows of Malabar Hill is set in early 20th century Bombay, now Mumbai. Purveen works in her father's law firm, which has been hired to execute a longtime client's will. But Purveen discovers something strange. All three of the client's widows have agreed to sign over their inheritances to charity, leaving them and their children with little to live on. Readers follow Purveen as she boldly searches for truth, confronting murder, kidnapping, and a secret passageway. The Widows of Malabar Hill is the latest novel of Sujata Massey, who lives in Baltimore and was a features reporter for the Baltimore Evening Sun before becoming a full-time novelist a couple decades ago. Sujata Massey, welcome to On the Record.
Thanks so much, Sheila. I'm happy to be here.
Purving Mistry is a fictional character, but she's based on some real pioneering women in Indian history.
That's right. The very first woman lawyer in the entire British Empire was an Indian woman named Cornelia Sarabji, who went to Oxford in the 1880s and began her work as a solicitor in the 1890s. And there was also a second Indian woman lawyer, Mitan Tata Lam, who did a lot to change divorce law in India to make it more equitable for women.
Is Pirving's last name Mystery, M-I-S-T-R-Y?
Yes.
Is that a nod to the puzzle she solves?
Well, it's actually a very common last name in her religious community. Pirving is a Zoroastrian. Her ancestors left Persia in, say, the 700 AD to go to India. And they had last names that corresponded with their jobs. And mystery actually means construction. And so she comes from a family that has a construction background. But I couldn't resist using the name because it's a play on words.
Which I didn't really focus on until I said it out loud because it looks different. Your book highlights many different cultures and ways these communities and their customs bump up against each other. You mentioned the Parsi community that is Pirving's family. Tell us more about the Parsis and the other groups in this book.
Sure. Well, my book is set in 1921. So India, half of the subcontinent was under British rule at that time. And the British had wanted, when they wanted to build Bombay, they had gotten the city of Bombay, now Mumbai, as a kind of wedding present from the Portuguese. So they wanted to build the thing. They wanted to build the city very well. So they invited the Parsis, who were in a different part of India, in Gujarat, and had done a lot of shipbuilding. They invited them to come and build the city. So that's why there are more Parsis, who are the Indian-born Zoroastrians, in Bombay than anywhere else. So it was a really, you know, busy, exciting time in the early 1920s. There were Zoroastrian people, there were Jewish people, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, and there was actually a lot more harmony between the groups in this day and age than there is today. So one of the things I've been able to do in the books is sort of show people going to each other's homes and show the relationships people had, where in a household you might have a family that's one religion, but a lot of people that do work in the house are of different faiths.
Well, how do you go about researching the legal and religious practices and the social practices?
Well, first of all, I'm in love with that city. Mumbai is wonderful. It's home to my stepfather and his family. So I sort of have a little bit of a head start in that I go there quite often and I can stay in the old part of the city. So I have the fun of talking to people who have been in Mumbai for a long time, who might be, say, a professor or a lawyer working in the area, and they can take me around and show me things. And I also have been delighted to find that a lot of old texts have been scanned and put online. So I've been able to read, you know, these original versions of the Parsi Marriage and Divorce Act. I've been able to look at old books which explain the whole Muslim legal code. So it just takes a lot of time to sit and sift through. But when you read those books, things jump out about how the law wasn't equal in terms of women. And I can look at how the laws are and think, how could I work that into a story?
That's Sujata Massey here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her latest novel, The Widows of Malabar Hill, a mystery set in 1920s Mumbai, India, starring the intrepid lawyer Pirving Mystery. Pirving's parents are very progressive, allowing their daughter to travel abroad, encouraging her career. And this contrasts with other characters in the book, including the Muslim widows who live in seclusion. How unusual would Pirving's parents have been for the early 1900s?
They would have been unusual if you look at India as a whole, but they were actually very typical for their community. The Parsis were all for women's education. Many principals at schools in Mumbai and throughout India are Parsis. And they were the country's first women lawyers were Parsis. And what I think about it is a lot of parents take pride through their children's actions, especially Asian parents. So for a daughter to be the city's first woman lawyer actually brought status to the family. And Pirving's father was really bent on her being that. And there's a period in the book where she's not so sure she wants to do that. she's rebelling a bit. And, you know, it's quite a journey that she actually comes around to be a lawyer. But that was always his intention, that somebody in the family had to be a lawyer. And if his son didn't have the talent, his daughter would do it.
There's a moment when police officers ask Pirving to fingerprint the widows, her clients, mm-hmm. because it would violate the widow's religious customs to be touched by a man. And Pirving replies, quote, "I very much understand the Crime Investigation Department's wish to be able to collect women's fingerprints. The police commissioner must begin hiring female constables, not ask lawyers to do it," close quote. Where does her courage come from to make that kind of confrontation?
Well, I think that she has a strong character, but she's also had these experiences watching her father argue in court. That's one of the things she loved to do as a little girl, is go to the Bombay High Court and watch him argue a case. And she also had the virtue of an Oxford education. And when women went to these schools and they were sitting in the class with men, they were exposed to, you know, pretty assertive behavior. And it was often said that the Indians who went to Britain came back with a lot more fight in them, because they could use the rules of the British against the British, because they understood what civil liberties were.
You did a book tour in India for the widows of Malabar Hill.
I did.
What reaction did you get from
readers
there?
Well, it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of sort of younger readers that were interested in the story. It seemed like a lot of connection with younger people. And there are, you know, these curiosities about other communities. You know, even though India is a majority Hindu country, there is a very kind of an interest and curiosity and positive feeling about these other religious groups. So that was one aspect. Another aspect is there are a lot of feminists in India. So there were quite a lot of women that were interested in the idea of a woman lawyer who's able to do things that nobody else can. And you look at India today, right now, a lot is going on where women are going into zones. They're starting to go to places like bars, for example, or going to the movies at night. Not everybody approves of that. So the struggle that Pirving is going through with the larger society to do her job is still echoed today in the struggle of, you know, women students who, yes, we can go to school, but we'd like to be able to go out and have a good time in the evening, too.
When it comes to pacing a mystery novel, how do you strike the balance between revealing information about the lives of your characters and revealing clues related to the mystery?
Well, it's a pretty tricky process, and I wouldn't say that I can keep everything in my brain and it comes out at exactly the right time. I outline my books before I start them, so I have an idea. That's how I get my pacing, because I look at what's going on in the outline, and I know, oh, Pirving is, she's just discovered a body, and that's pretty exciting. And if we take the reader out of that for a few minutes, they can't wait to get back to that story. But wouldn't it be interesting if we can tell something about her past based on having seen the body? So there are ways that you thread through information in the book. And I've been doing this for a long time. This is my 14th book. So I feel a little more comfortable doing it now, but I also realize what a serious undertaking it is.
How long does it take you to write a book?
Well, it takes me a little longer than a year to write a book. And we're trying to have them published one a year. So, you know, it's a tight schedule. Definitely.
What's next for your heroine, Pirving Mystery?
Yeah, well, book two is coming out next year. And the title for that book is The Satipur Moonstone. And this is a mystery where Pirving leaves British India and goes into princely India, the section of the subcontinent that was actually ruled by Indians, albeit in the British back pocket. You know, they had to, the Maharajas who ruled these kingdoms had to continuously supply crops and money to the British in exchange for the right to rule the kingdom. And so she gets involved in a case there. and it's got lots of jewels. It's got lots of animals. I got to learn a lot about monkeys and leopards and dogs, and so I had fun with that.
I can imagine your readers are eager for that to be published.
I hope so. It's going to come out here in the United States and also in India.
Let us know when it does, okay?
I will.
Sujata Massey is author of more than a dozen mystery novels and winner of the Agatha and McCavity Awards for mystery writing. She lives in Baltimore. Her latest book is The Widows of Malabar Hill. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have a link to Sujata Massey's events later this summer, including one on Thursday, August 2nd at Mystery Loves Company in Oxford, Maryland. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.